few days ago, exactly 16th of February, the date which was predicted as a most probable day of Russian invasion into Ukraine, we as a board of Yalta European Strategy, with my fellow board members Alexander Kwasniewski, Kirsty Kolylight, Carl Bill, Stefan Fuchs, we visited eastern Ukraine, Dnipropetrovsk city, just 200 kilometers from line of the contact. We met with the students, with the local authorities, with the workers on different steel factories, and we asked them, what do you think, what we have to tell to people in Munich Security Conference, your main message, what they, this is like a summary, here is what they said. We will fight. First, we are tense, but we don't panic. We don't believe really it will happen, but if it happens, we are ready. And we do count on your, Europe's and the West's strong and full support. We hope you feel your responsibility. This is our message for Munich. Look, already 5 years we host this, our Ukrainian lunch. But this conference mainly, unfortunately, mainly about Ukraine. That's why I can call this conference Munich Ukrainian Security Conference. And that's why I cannot call this lunch as Ukrainian lunch. Just to make it simple, this is lunch break during our Munich Ukrainian Security Conference. We have many great friends, many very, very interesting speakers. Thank you very much for your support. Our moderator, I think we were lucky, we have fantastic moderator, Zani Mentan Bidas. She's chief editor of The Economist. Zani, very, floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor. It's on. Can you hear me?
Yes, it is on now. Thank you. Hello, everybody. You don't need me to tell you how important this lunch is. It is really, I think, hard to exaggerate the importance of this conference and of this lunch at this conference. We are in the midst of the biggest European security crisis in decades. As President Biden said, we are on the brink of a catastrophic and needless war of choice. The future of a sovereign nation is on the line. The future of European security, as so many ministers said this morning, is on the line. So it could not be more important. We have an extraordinarily good panel to answer and debate this, and I hope to call on many of you from the audience. But let me first invite immediately, with no ado, the esteemed panelists, Anne Applebaum, who is an author and staff writer at The Atlantic, author of some of the most trenchant commentary, I would say, on this crisis. General James Mattis, now senior counselor at the Cohen Group, former defense secretary of the United States. General Mattis, come up and join us. Do you want to come and join us up here? And General David Petraeus, chairman of KKR Global Institute, now former CIA director. General Petraeus, where are you? Would you like to come and join us? Ann Linde, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Sweden. Ann, please come and join us, Minister. And Mircea Joana, Deputy Secretary General of NATO. Mr. Joana, please come and join us. While they are taking their seats, we have a couple of questions for you to vote on. You should have voting machines on your chairs. And I just want to ask two, because I want to get the mood of this room. The first question, is the West today showing itself strong and united enough to contain Russian aggression? Simple answer, yes or no. And if as many of you as possible could answer this, we really will get the sense of the mood of one of the most informed audiences in the world. Is the West strong and united enough? Will you tell me when there is an answer? Have we had enough people vote? seems to be taking a little time. Yes, please vote. I know you want to have your lunch, and that's important too, but this is an important question to vote on. I'm going to ask you one other one in a second. But this one is the West united and strong enough? Do we have an answer? Do we have enough people vote to get an answer? Frankly, this is a little alarming if the West can't get itself together to ask an answer. No, that is interesting. A majority of those voting say the West is not united enough to deter Russian aggression. Okay, second and last question. Will there be war? And let me clarify. By war, I mean a full-on invasion of Ukraine towards Kiev. I do not mean separatist activity in the Donbas region. A full-on invasion of Ukraine. Will there be war? Including Kiev. Including Kiev. So the maximalist interpretation. What President Biden seemed to suggest yesterday is what he thought President Putin was planning for. Will there be a maximalist war? And while we get the answer to that, we will start our conversation. And Minister Linda, I'm going to start with you, because that was a rather sobering result there from the audience. The majority of the audience does not think the West is united enough. What is your perspective on that?
I would say that we are more united now than we were before this whole thing started in the autumn. I can say, being a minister in EU, that we have had for quite a long time discussions on how we are going to meet Russia. And there has been different positions on this, a little more, you know, soft, a little bit more hard. And if we should keep to the five principles, including continuing to give the responsibility for what has happened for the last 8 years with 14,000 dead in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And there is now a much, much more unity. And what is more important, a transatlantic unity. The unity between United States, Canada, EU, UK is in a on a level that we have not seen for a very long time. And this is, of course, not only in words, it's also in deeds.
Thank you. And those are indeed words. You echo words that we have heard from President von der Leyen, from many ministers this morning. But the voting in this room just now suggests that even this audience does not believe you, and that a majority of this audience thinks the West is not united enough. And in case you missed it just then, the answer to the second question was even more sobering. Over 60% of this audience thinks there will be a full-scale invasion. The answer to the second question... Oh, it was the other way around? I'm sorry, I must have misread it. Okay, phew. They don't believe. Okay, 60% don't believe. Well, that's... I'm sorry, this is my eyesight. Well, almost 40% of you think there will be, so that's still pretty worrying. Right, it's not as bad as I thought. Mr. Joanna, what do you take from the answer to those two questions? People do not seem to think, and majority does not think the West is united enough, but fortunately, a majority does not think there will be a war.
If I would put the same question in a different perspective, I would say that we don't know that if this unprecedented unity of the West will be the situation or not to deter Russia from again invading Ukraine. Something we don't know. But I know one thing, and I can guarantee from within NATO, where 30 nations are meeting and not seeing every day on other issues eye to eye all the time. But if I would ask the question, would NATO and the political West maintain the unity on the consequences on Russia if they decide to invade Ukraine again? I will say that I can say to this group and to the public opinion that the unity of the West will be there. Hopefully this will deter Russia from invading. But if Russia takes the unfortunate decision, a massive strategic mistake from Russia, in our perspective, to still invade, I can guarantee
that the West is more united than ever. NATO, EU, we are working closer than ever. US, Canada, UK, Norway, and all the others who are not in the EU, working closely together. So the consequence on Russia, political, economic, technological, long-term, reputation-wise, will be exceptionally severe. And for this question, I can guarantee. I cannot guarantee the first one because it's Mr. Putin deciding in the end.
Yep.
But on the second one, I can guarantee you will be rock solid as a united political West.
Thank you. And that's extremely clear. And we will spend most of our discussion on the second question, because as you say, the answer to the first involves amateur psychoanalysis of what is going on the head of President Putin. But I would just like to spend a little time on the first question, because we have two, you know, of the world's greatest military experts on the stage. And so, David Petraeus, I was going to start with you. You have, let us say, successfully invaded a number of countries. You've personally masterminded invasions. When you look at what is happening on the ground, and when you look at the open source intelligence, and it's remarkable what we can now all see, even those of us who are not professionals, what do you think is going on?
Well, thanks for remembering what we did back in our youth, General Mattis and me. But first of all, let me just say thanks to Victor. It is wonderful of you to have this gathering every year, but never has there been the kind of turnout that we see with the congressional delegation, Ambassador McCain, and a variety of others who are here. I actually was at the Yalta European Strategy Gathering or Summit when it was still at Yalta, I might add, in 2013. Obviously, the YES summit, the Yalta summit, has had to be held in Kyiv ever since Russia appropriated Crimea and also the Donbass. So gathering us on the eve of what we hope will not be an invasion, but which requires, I think, the kind of support and unity and so forth that we've discussed is hugely important. You know, in the intelligence business and the military business, what we assess generally are capabilities. We're trying to determine intent, as you say, to determine what is in Vladimir Putin's mind, but we're not psychologists. However, we can count and we can observe. And what really has been striking and I think most worrisome in recent weeks has been the deployment, not of the tanks and the infantry and all the rest of that. It's the deployment of the so-called enablers. It's the combat support, artillery and the rest, the refueling, the hospital. When you see field hospitals set up, you don't need field hospitals for an exercise. You need those for an invasion. And that is what is particularly concerning. Again, as a division commander on the flank of General Mattis, who had the Marine 1st Division, I was privileged to command the 101st Airborne Division, 254 helicopters. Logistics are what are keeping you awake at night. We know how to fight. The question is, can we actually pump 500,000 gallons of JP-8, this aviation fuel, which we did in 2 weeks? Think of the logistics. That's what we are seeing now, and that's what is really concerning, I think. And I suspect, Jim, that, again, what kept you, what was gnawing at you wasn't whether your Marines would fight or not. It's whether you nugged all the logistical details to enable them to fight and to provide the kind of support they need in a tough fight.
And that is now in place. General Mattis, what's your take on this, and particularly how long can Russia keep up credibly this degree of military presence and pressure on Ukraine's borders?
Well, first, I'd agree 100% with how General Petraeus, how David just characterized the Russian preparations. If we were meeting a week ago, we would not be able to speak with that firmness. But this is what he's done in the last week. I think that what you have to look at here is how long can he keep those troops in the field in that position? He can keep them there as long as he wishes and as long as he's willing to pay the price. Because it's not like they're having meetings like this in Moscow right now. There are no dissenting voices in Moscow. Right now, he does whatever he wants to do. And I think, while none of us know what he has in mind, he is a creature, as far as I'm concerned, straight out of Dostoevsky. He sees Russia surrounded by nightmares. And there's only two kinds of states he wants on his periphery. The one to do exactly what he says, and enemies. So unless Ukraine is willing to violate its own sovereignty, I would be very pessimistic about the next couple of days and weeks that he may very well move. He doesn't have to. If he can get, if he can keep the initiative without moving, he won't. But he has put the enablers in place. He is ready to move, and he has the capability. The problem for him is going to be the day after, I guarantee you. The unity of the West will make sure of that.
Thank you. We're going to turn to the unity of the West in a second. But last, on this first round, Anne Applebaum, to you. You have written trenchantly and excellently about the shortcomings that the West has had in its approach to this crisis. What is your sense now? Do you think, how do you react to these polling questions? Do they surprise you? And secondly, do you think the West is being strong and united enough?
My criticism of the West and is not universal. I think that the Biden administration's decision to reveal intelligence from the very beginning, which is a very original and different way of countering Russian disinformation and propaganda, is going to be studied for a long time as a lesson in how to preempt a disinformation campaign, a false flag operation before it happened. I really admire that. I think the, particularly in the last couple of days and including at this conference, the degree to which Western leaders are now seeking to telegraph unity, you know, repeatedly in different fora, we're working together, you know, we've just heard from NATO, we hear from foreign ministers and leaders of states, that's excellent. What continues to worry me is whether Putin has been convinced that the price he will pay is high enough. So one of the things I've been saying from the beginning is that this is not really about a negotiation. It's not about whether the expansion of NATO. These are secondary concerns. This is for Putin. The existence of a sovereign, independent Ukraine is a fundamental challenge to his form of government, his autocracy, his kleptocracy. And therefore, to undermine Ukraine, to make sure that Ukraine doesn't succeed, is something he considers fundamental to his own power. And therefore, deterring him is not about talking him out of it or about offering him some piece of paper or some kind of promises. Deterring him is about saying, here's the cost you will pay, and it will be very high. I don't know what's said behind closed doors about sanctions. I'm told it's very tough, which I'm glad to hear about. I worry that the military deterrence, the shipment of weapons to Ukraine, has not been sufficient. And I suspect the pessimism in this room, which is a room that knows that part of the story very well, is explained by that. It's the fear that we haven't armed Ukraine enough, we haven't prepared Ukraine enough, maybe Ukraine hasn't prepared itself enough.
That's really interesting. And I want to perhaps we'll turn, Mr. Joanna, to you again to really answer that challenge. Has Ukraine prepared enough, and has the West prepared enough militarily, helped prepare Ukraine enough militarily? Because I think Anne raises the key question, which is the West prepared to inflict a high enough price on Vladimir Putin, given where he is right now?
Especially to this audience, we should not forget that Ukraine has been at war, and Russia has been at war against Ukraine for the last 8 years. It never stopped. Every single time we are meeting our Ukrainian partners, from President Zelensky all the way to Minister Kuleba and his administration, I always hear, and we hear reports that more and more young Ukrainians have been shot by snipers. This country has been at war, not a traditional one, but a subdued one, but continuous one for the last 8 years. So yes, the armed forces of Ukraine have improved dramatically. We also helped in terms of training. As we speak, Canada is doing a lot. Many allies do a little thing with them. I cannot say and I cannot measure in public which will be the capacity of Ukraine, armed forces, to eventually resist, but I know that they will fight for their land. I know they will fight for their freedom. I know that Mr. Putin is getting the opposite of his intentions. And Ukraine, that is even more convinced than ever that it belongs with a democratic Europe. The second thing is what NATO does for its allies, because Ukraine is part of the enhanced opportunity partnership with us with NATO. We appreciate this. Georgia is the same. But we are now speaking of Article 5 guarantees. And you heard from President Biden, from Vice President Harris this morning. And I have to say that I've never seen in my long political and diplomatic career ever the U.S. engaging more intensely and more intimately with all its allies and partners. Never, ever. There is not one day without some senior official from Washington briefing allies in NATO or talking to the EU. As we speak, the U.S. has put at the disposal of the NATO Reaction Force 8,500 additional troops. If you look into the Mediterranean, for the first time since the Cold War, USS Harry S. Truman has been put under NATO Maritime Command. We are patrolling the skies and the seas, not only in the Black Sea or in the Baltic Sea, but in the High North, in the Mediterranean. I've seen in Lithuania, I was in Vilnius last week with our allies in Lithuania, I've seen Germany sending additional troops to Lithuania. I've seen the UK sending more troops. I see the US sending to my country, Romania, to Poland, additional troops. I'm seeing a level of vigilance and prudence, non-escalatory from NATO, like we have never done before. So when President Biden says, and the American bipartisan political body says that one square inch of NATO will not go undefended, we mean that. Meanwhile, we have to help and assist Ukraine. What NATO is doing for Ukraine, we help them on cyber, we help them on hybrid, we help them on the immense disinformation and intoxication campaign which this country is subject of from Russia. So what we do as NATO is important. What bilateral allies do and partners do is also very important. So I know that Ukraine is a proud nation that will never be accepted to be subjugated or being, you know, subject of some form of... If you are a young Ukrainian, would you like to live in dictatorship or in democracy? If you're a young Ukrainian, would you like to be afraid that if you speak up to power, you might end in prison? Or you like to be able to change your leaders democratically? So I think Mr. Putin is getting the opposite of what he intends. A more independent and sovereign Ukraine, more leaning towards the West, a united NATO, and an impeccable leadership from the U.S. of our alliance. So that's the opposite of what Mr. Putin intended.
Thank you. And we have members of the large bipartisan U.S. delegation here, and I'd like to call on some of you a little later. And also, just to let you know that, unfortunately, President Zelensky will not address this lunch. He is here briefly, but will not be able to join this. But we hope that Foreign Minister Kuleva will be able to. And I will get a word. He's not here yet, but when he is, we would obviously very much like to hear from him. Let me build on what you said and ask whether the two of you share the view that this is unprecedented cooperation and unprecedented effectively working of NATO. David.
I think that is correct, certainly since the end of the Cold War. I mean, we're both, you know, went all the way through, I guess, major or something like that. In fact, my first time at the Munich Security Conference was as a speechwriter for the Supreme Allied Commander at the height of the Cold War. And there was an extraordinary amount of unity at that time, needless to say. But since then, obviously, there has been a bit of an identity crisis at various times. NATO has been in search of a mission, of a reason for living. And I have to say that Vladimir Putin has been the greatest gift to NATO since the end of the Cold War. And this massing of forces has generated what I think it is accurate to say is an unprecedented level of commitment. And quite an innovative way, led by a U.S. president and administration, as Ann mentioned, to lay this all out. Every time Russia creates some pretext for an invasion, the U.S. is laying out this is what really happened, and exposing Russia for all the world to see using open source intelligence and presumably intelligence from other sources and methods without exposing those sources and methods. So I think this has been quite extraordinary. You know, will it be enough? That we cannot know, as we all agreed. We don't know what will be enough to change the calculation of Vladimir Putin, what might lead him to draw back at the last minute before looking, you know, diving into the abyss. And clearly there's a question out there, Zanny, that I hope that we can hear from perhaps some of the Ukrainian delegation here. A big question is, will the Ukrainians fight? Will Ukraine be a porcupine that is indigestible by the Russian bear, or will the troops surrender and so forth? I have a degree of confidence. By the way, I've been to the front lines in the Donbass several years ago before the pandemic lockdown, and they are determined. And I think that, if anything, obviously they've gotten better and better and better since 2014. And I have a pretty good degree of confidence that they are going to fight and that these partisan brigades are going to fight. Victor shared some polling results earlier that, you know, over half of those polled in Ukraine, this is half of the entire population, so everybody, half of them said, yeah, I'm going to take up a weapon and fight the Russians if they come into my country. That is a big deal. And for the U.S. delegation, we should be asking ourselves, how quickly are we going to reassure them that we will provide everything that they need if indeed they show the will to fight, in addition to what we've already flown in there, by the way. And to be fair, we've flown a lot of C-17 loads of Javelins and Stingers and other weapon systems that, while defensive in nature, can make an invader pay a very heavy price.
So you raised two important questions here. One is, and I think we've probably covered as well as we can, the initial question of what we know about whether or not there will be an invasion. But now let's move on to the, I think, important question that Anne Applebaum raised, which is there a willingness to go beyond the very clear expressions of unity to sanctions and responses that will be effective and that will stay in place? And Minister Linda, I was going to start with you with that. I mean, it is relatively easy to say we stand united, and it is relatively easy to say we have been working together on an unprecedented set of sanctions. How confident are you that that set of sanctions would be maximalist and would be lasting, and that Europeans would be united in that?
Well, thank you. And since I and a few of my colleagues here are those who are actually going to take that very decision, which we are about 30 persons who are actually going to take the decisions of sanction or not, I can tell you that it's a long time ago since I've been so sure that this time there will be massive sanction and it will be coordinated. Just a week before the discussions in Brussels and Geneva, I went to meet Wendy Sherman and Jonathan Feiner in Washington, where we coordinated also what sectors are we going to see, what individuals, how are we going to have the sanctions. And I have to say, this time EU is also prepared. I see Svetlana is in the audience. Hi. And unfortunately, when it comes to sanction to Belarus, it was not prepared in that way. And it took way too long time before we could unite to have sanction. Now we have five packages of sanction on Belarus, and we learned a lesson. Don't do that mistake again. And I also think that to be able to have it for a long term, it's this unity that is the most important thing. And I have to say also that this will have a cost both for the Ukrainians, but just like General Petraeus, I visited Ukraine many times, actually the first time when it was part of Soviet Union in 1988, and just three times to the contact line now at the last 12 or 15 months. And my admiration for the Ukrainian people in withstanding this constant threat to their very existence and going through the history in these very, very difficult times from being part of the Soviet Union until now, that's absolutely remarkable. So all of us take our hat off for the resistance for the Ukrainian people.
Anne Applebaum, how do you react to that and answer your own question? How confident are you that there will be this sustained support for sanctions and indeed for arming Ukraine?
The trouble with sanctions up until now, aside from the one that the minister has described, which is that we're so often caught by surprise, we're not prepared, and so on. This time we are, and that makes a difference. The trouble in the past has been that we have, for example, in the past, selectively sanctioned wealthy Russians, some who were very close to Putin. And then over time, they got fake passports, they transferred their wealth to their wives or to their relatives. They found ways around the sanctions, and many people know that this happened and many people understand it. And I think we also have to be prepared for the fact that there will be groups inside the West, in the business community, some in the various pro-Russian or far-right factions that exist inside all of our countries, that will oppose the sanctions, will seek ways around the sanctions, and may even be bribed by the Russians or helped by the Russians to get around the sanctions. And so thinking ahead, just as we're thinking ahead now about sanctions, thinking ahead about that is something that I hope NATO foreign ministers and heads of finance ministers will also think about in the next several days and weeks. You know, how are we going to ensure these sanctions remain in place? How are we going to treat people who cheat on them? What will be the repercussions? What will be the consequences? Because we haven't thought about those things thoroughly enough in the past before. And if we really want things to be different this time, we need to take that into consideration. People will try to cheat. They'll have motivation to do it. There'll be money involved in doing it. And anticipating that is going to be the key to making sure this.
Before I open to some questions and comments from the audience, but one thing that I have wondered about is if these massive sanctions are placed on Russia, is Russia likely not to react itself? And in which way is it going to react? Cyber attacks, whatever forms of escalation do you worry about? And what is the escalatory potential and logic of this conflict?
I think you're hitting the nail right on the head. What is going to be unleashed with this earthquake if Putin invades is unpredictable. And so we're going to have to be prepared for what comes next. One thing, 100,000 troops can invade the Ukraine. Yes, 100,000 troops cannot hold the Ukraine. So there's going to be trouble there. Then when you put the sanctions in place and people start messing around, and now Putin's on the horns of a dilemma, he is going to act. Just look at his past behavior, pretty good indicator. And so what we're going to have to do is recognize it's not what we do right now, it's what we can sustain, and that includes wargaming it, keeping the EU tightly linked to NATO, so that when they make a mistake in one area and they try something, we don't just address that issue. We broaden the competitive space and say the first day of sanctions were bad, the third day are 10 times worse. In other words, you misbehave here, more things are going to go wrong. But there's got to be an accountability here, because it's not going to be over with one set of sanctions put out there. There, we did our job and we'll maintain them. It's going to grow. It's going to mushroom. And this is where the miscalculations can get very, very dangerous. The need for a very firm unity, for anticipation, and for no compromise on basic principles is going to be paramount.
General Petraeus.
It will be especially tough if Russia decides to use its energy weapon, given the dependence of many of the countries in Eastern and Western Europe on Russian natural gas, some on crude oil, refined products, and so forth. Now, to be fair, there's been quite a bit of work on that, and we heard some of that from the stage about how Japan, for example, has agreed to allow cargoes to go to LNG to go to Europe. They've been out scouring around trying to find other shipments that can be diverted. But still, that's going to be difficult. There will be a price in Europe in particular when it comes to the cost of natural gas, which is already, as you well know, very, very high. As a result of the supply and demand mismatch at present. So it's that kind of action, in addition to cyber attacks and a variety of other activities that could take place, that will cause a real bite. And this is where this unity may be tested. But so far, I think you have to acknowledge that, you know, Putin's a guy who shakes a tree to see what falls out. And what has fallen out so far, actually, is greater NATO unity. It's more troops in the eastern flank of NATO. He has not driven a wedge between Europe and North America. He's not driven a wedge between EU and NATO members. So far, this is not working out exactly according to plan. And it's that that gives a tiny bit of hope still, I think, that in the calculations that he may draw back at the last minute. But as others have mentioned, there aren't too many people in the room with, number one, there aren't many people in the room with him at all. Number two, they're separated by a long table. But number three, there aren't many who will say, you know, Mr. Putin, that may not be the greatest of idea. Maybe you should sit under a tree until that thought passes.
Absolutely. One quick intervention from you, Mr. John, and then I'm going to open to the many foreign ministers in the audience.
Listen, you have been hearing us and Secretary General Stoltenberg and myself speaking about hoping for the best, and a diplomatic solution is still possible. A diplomatic solution is the best way forward for us and for Russia. But to also say, after a small coma, hoping for the best, but preparing for the worst. So when I say this, I'm not saying in a threatening way. I'm saying that we are anticipating from all directions, from cyber, from multiple geographies, because as we are, for good reasons, concentrated on Ukraine, the eastern flank, the Baltic Sea, the Black Sea, we see Russia also in other places, in the Balkans, in North Africa, in Africa, in the high north, even in Venezuela. So what I'm just trying to say that let's give diplomacy a chance. This is what we do. Secretary General has sent a new letter to Lavrov just 2 days ago, telling them come back to the NATO-Russia Council. That's the way to move forward. If they reject this genuine offer from us to find together mutually acceptable solutions for European security, this will be the best way forward. If not, unfortunately, we have to be prepared for the worst.
We will, I hope, have some time to see, to explore what some of those solutions might look like and perhaps come up with some in this room. But before that, I wanted to ask a few of you to really dwell a bit on this question of what happens not just on day two or day three, but week one, week two, month one, month two of this, and to test European and NATO unity. And maybe Peter Hultqvist, Minister of Defence of Sweden, if you could give us your perspective first. Peter, where are you? There you are, right there. You've heard, as we heard from the main stage at the MSC this morning, expressions of determination and unity. But in the face of Russian willingness to escalate, how confident are you?
I think we have a high level of unity just now. It has developed all the time. And if I compare with what we can call normal defense minister meetings in European Union and NATO, I think then we talk about a lot of things in different parts of Europe and also different parts of the world. And we have also tensions about, if we compare with these small questions. Now we have a big challenge. And now I see that we try to be united. I think that it was very appreciated by all the defense ministers that we have one letter to Moscow. And also the same in European Union and NATO, both organizations. That was very, very important. Then what will happen? I think we have a platform to develop the unity step by step because of what's happening around us. When the Russians make their moves, we also must make our moves. And then if we do it in unity, I think we can be strong. And that is the main point, to be strong together. That is the only way to handle this. And then one other thing. All this is about very easy questions. It's all about authoritarianism against democracies. It's the way of living, it's the way of freedom, it's the right for ordinary people to have to make their choices, and it's also the right for sovereign states to make their choices. When that is challenged, then it's very easy, I think, to be together, and we have a goal to fight for.
Thank you. That's very clear, and you echo a very powerful sentiment from everybody. But I want to try and get beyond the expression of unity to try and delve into what does this actually mean in practice. And maybe I could ask the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Denmark, Jeppe Kofod, what your perspective is. What is going to happen? Let us posit that the tanks roll in the next 48 hours. Just talk me through what the reaction in Europe is going to be. What conversations are you going to be drawn into? What concretely is going to happen?
Well, yeah, thank you so much. Just on that point, of course, we will gather very quickly. And hopefully, we will fulfill the promise that we have made. We will impose the most devastating sanctions ever seen on Russia, economically, politically. And I have to make one point here, because there is discussions, sanctions is expensive, also economically, for our businesses, for our people in Europe. That's true. But I can guarantee you 100%, if we react with too few sanctions or too less, then the price will be much, much higher. Because what's at stake now?
Keep talking.
What's at stake now is actually not only European security and Ukraine security, that in itself is very serious, but it's an authoritarian, brutal reality of the world we are in, where we need to stand up for our values much more systematically, and that comes with a price. This attack on Ukraine has been going on since 2014, as we know, but there's several attacks from Russia's side, cyber, hybrid warfare. We see that many, many times. You see attempts to kill opposition leaders in Russia, Salisbury 2018 and so on. You see Navalny being branded as a terrorist. You see the Duma election. We're not able to send observers from the OSCE. We have this clash, and there we need to stand up. So I'm very actually excited by the fact that people here are united, and I'm hope that when it comes to crunch time, that they can also impose the sanctions we are asking for, because at the end of the day, if we make it so expensive for Putin and his regime, then there's also more likelihood that change will come eventually to Russia. Because I believe in the long run, if we support in a clever way, we would also see a Russia, maybe not in the next 5, 10, 15 years, but longer run, that can survive the authoritarianism that Putin and his people have put into this. But we need to stand up for our freedom right now, and Ukraine is in the forefront of that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to come back to some other foreign ministers in a second to ask about sanctions, but first, Svetlana Tsinovskaya. Oh my goodness me. Tsikhanouskaya. Yeah, I was trying to massively mispronounce your name. I'm so sorry about that. Svetlana, could you give us your sense? You watch this, I imagine, with more than a little powerful emotion. What do you think of the West's response? How credible do you think it is? And what could the West have learned from your experience?
You know, hello, everyone, and thanks for invitation. And first of all, on behalf of Belarusian people, let me express our solidarity to our neighbors in this crucial moment of our history. You know, Belarusian fate is depend on the fate of Ukraine and vice versa. Our extremely close and friendly nations share centuries of common history and common challenges. Without a free Ukraine is difficult to imagine that Belarusians will get rid of a dictator and preserve our independence. But Ukraine also needs a democratic and independent neighbor, Belarus. And to never again, even a nightmare, I couldn't imagine that the Belarusian land could pose a threat to Ukraine. Really, Ukrainians have shown an example of fearless struggle for their dignity, and Ukrainians still pays a high price for this. And among your heroes, there are Belarusians also, because Ukraine is also defending our future. So Ukrainians' lesson to us is that values are not given for nothing, that they must be protected. And the vast majority of the Belarusian people have sympathy for Ukraine, and we are against the war and involving Belarus in anti-Ukraine aggressive sanctions. The dictator Lukashenko is responsible for bringing foreign troops to Belarus, which threatens both Ukrainian and Belarus independence. And moreover, he wants to eliminate neutrality and nuclear status from the constitution in order to allow Russian nukes on our territory. And as well as Ukrainians, we do remember the Budapest Memorandum and expect reaction from the democratic world. Dictator cannot be a guarantor of independence in Belarus, and he cannot be a reliable partner of democracies. He was so scared by people on the streets in our country that he decided to surrender the sovereignty of Belarus. And important lesson of the Belarusian Revolution of 2020 is that freedom, democracy, and state sovereignty are inseparable. People who stood for right to freely elect their leaders realized that it's possible only in a free and independent Belarusian state. And lack of mass protests in Belarus now doesn't mean that people gave up. The dictator knows this and therefore continues repressions in our country. We also have our own mourning list of deaths. The number of political prisoners in our country is growing every day. But even a small trigger will be enough for Belarus to rise again. And only the free Belarusian people will be the guarantor of the Belarus independence and its free choice of future path. And I'm sure that Ukrainians who have gone through such a path understanding us and will be among those who will support our way. So, Slava Ukraini and Zhive Belarus. Thank you.
Thank you, Svetlana Tsinuskaya. Thank you very much. I think a sobering reminder as we talk about sanctions and persistence of where the West has perhaps not lived up to that. Let us now continue with Melanie Joly, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Canada. Minister Joly, I wanted to ask you a version of the same question I have asked other ministers, which is, you know, not on day one, but on week one or week two, the determination with which you are willing to maintain sanctions. And I think it is worth remembering that the history of sanctions as an effective tool is mixed at best. So let us assume the West is unified in putting on these devastating sanctions. Do you think the unanimity will last, the unity will last to keep them on? And what happens if Russia escalates?
Well, you know, you've been talking, all of us have been talking about how much we're united. But unity always comes in front of a threat. And for, I think, in a long, long time, the threat is coming from one country. And that's why we're so united. Nothing like one villain to unite everybody. And so in that sense, we're extremely coordinated. We have worked with the UK, with the US, with Australia already on our sanctions, and Canada being that middle power that is really good friends to the US, but also friends to the EU, we've been bridging a lot and making sure that we're in connection, particularly with France and Germany. So on day one, our package is already ready. But we know also that on day two, on day three, on day four, we will add names, we will add entities, and we'll add individuals. So that's the goal, and we want to make sure that the pressure continues. Meanwhile, what we will be doing is we want to stay in Ukraine as long as possible. We have 1.4 million Ukrainian Canadians. We have one of the biggest diaspora outside Ukraine. We're one of the best friends to Ukraine. We've trained 30,000 reservists and soldiers of the armed forces and National Guard since 2014. So we've been there. And in that sense, that's why we decided to establish ourselves as long as possible in Lviv to have our consular service there, our ambassador there. So we didn't close our embassy, but we moved our embassy. And we think it's the best way to make sure that not only the Canadians that are there can continue to stay there, but also that we're there to support the government that will be there. Because our understanding is that the Ukrainian government will stay in Kyiv as long as possible, which is extremely important to show the courage and the resolve to its own people to continue to fight.
Thank you very much. Now, Wolfgang Ischinger, I wanted to turn to you, Wolfgang. As you have said from this podium at the conference itself many times in the last 24 hours, the stakes could not be higher. In your experience, are you convinced by these expressions of unity? And what worries you most about the potential European and NATO reaction?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. Thanks, Victor, for having me, and thank you all for being here for this weekend, and especially for the one issue. I don't remember at any time during the last 14 years that our conference was so dominated by one issue. And this is the one we're talking about here. That's never been the case, quite frankly. That's worrisome, of course, but it's also unifying, as you just said, and I totally agree. Now, I worry most, having served for 4 decades as diplomat, I worry most about surprise, unprecedented surprise, which I think the Russian government is capable of and has demonstrated before. I think we were taken by surprise in 2014. It took us not only a couple of hours, it took us days to understand what about the little green men. So I'm worried about surprise. I wonder whether we have, I assume we have done that, but I don't know that. I'm no longer part of our government. Whether we thought through all the possibilities that could be confronting us and that could conceivably divide us. And quite frankly, as you said, David, it's obvious there are potentially divisive issues, including energy. And it is not, I'm not here to defend, you know, the Nord Stream 2 company or so. But I just want to make the very modest point that this is not a small problem in German domestic politics. It is a significant that our government somehow needs to navigate, and I think we have been making a lot of progress on this, but these issues are potentially divisive. I don't know how German households would react if they can't heat their homes. Or if any problem arises in this connection. So this is really my major worry. I worry less about the military implications. I think NATO is really well prepared, but I worry about the broader public. And finally, let me add a domestic political point. Of course, we have in Germany, and we don't have the time to reason about this and why is it the case, but we have in Germany a significant minority view among the population that is not only anti-American, but that is pro-Russian. And you can't imagine the number of emails and WhatsApp messages, etc., that I get every day, and I'm sure the German politicians around the tables here have the same experience. When I say something which is seen as a negative comment about Russia, I get immediately an entire truckload of negative comments. You are a servant of the people who invaded Iraq. You know, it's that kind of stuff. And that may be existing in other countries too, but I think it is a particularly difficult one for us to manage and for those who lead German policy. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a sobering reminder, Wolfgang, thank you, that there are tensions within the polities of Europe that make the persistence of unity perhaps harder than it it's relatively easy to say now, and we can be impressed by the frequency and power with which it's said. I wanted to turn now to some of our Ukrainian friends here. First of all, Alina Mikhailova, are you here? Would you like to give us your perspective? Are you listening to this conversation, and are you confident, more confident, or more worried?
Thank you. Hello, my name is Alina Mikhailova. Thank you for inviting me to speak today. I'm 27, and I already spent 3 years at war. I am Russian-Ukrainian war veteran, and today I am a deputy of Kyiv City Council. I want you to know that war in Ukraine is not about potential invasion. It's there today and this and now. And actually, it's there already for 8 years. Ukrainians are united today as never before. Army, civil society, politics, business, all wants to protect our country. We also feel a big support from our international partners. Thank you so much for that. But in my opinion, it's not enough. We can do more, we can do better, and a lot needs to be done. We need your support, not because we are weak, but because we fight against one of the biggest armies in the world. We need to protect our country, but not only our country. It's about values and security of Europe and the whole world. Ukraine today is a frontier in fight for freedom and rights to make its own choice. My nation knows how to survive. We have lived through wars, occupation, holodomors, repressions, and revolutions, and we know how to fight back. But we can't survive all the time. We need to stop and develop our country. I dream not to receive everyday news from war about people's died or injured, but about achievements of Ukraine in science, sports, culture, economy. Many say that we can stop war in a military way. Maybe, but please, let's unite and help us to stop it in economy way. Increase the sanctions. Don't do business with aggressor. Don't do business with Putin. Do you realize that money that you invest in Russia today, tomorrow come to annexed Crimea or occupied territories of Donetsk and Lugansk regions? Some people don't understand that Ukraine wants to join to NATO and why we want to do it so much. It's not because we want to be a member of a big club, but because it's a question of security, security of Ukraine and security of Europe. Russia tries to harm our economy, show military aggression and sea blockades. It tries to set panic among Ukrainians. Russian hack attacked our banking and energy systems. And they also try, to put pro-Russian government in Ukraine. But I'm sure that Ukraine will win this war. I dream it happens soon with not many victims. But for this, we strongly need your support, support our international partners and friends. And I want to be sure that you all stand stronger to protect me, my country Ukraine, Europe, and the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Alina Mikhailova. Thank you. We now have Dmytro Kuleva, the Ukrainian foreign minister. Thank you for taking time from what I imagine is an incredibly packed couple of hours. Could you give us two things? First, your immediate sense of where things are going. And secondly, for this audience, what would you like the West to do?
Yes, hello to everybody. Enjoy your meals. Thank you for having me here. I'm happy to see some friends, some colleagues. It is true that the situation deteriorates every hour. The latest is the fake statements by the Russian Federation that two Ukrainian shells fell in the territory of Russia. Around 101 kilometer away from the Russian-Ukrainian border. We were not shooting. These are not our shells. This is the last thing that we would be interested to see to further escalate the situation. We still are focused on mobilizing diplomacy and taking every opportunity that diplomacy gives to us to prevent further escalation, but of course in the end it all depends on the goodwill of Russia, and it's Russia who has to demonstrate that goodwill. I came here from a meeting with G7 foreign ministers. I also had a meeting with Secretary of State. We exchanged information, and they asked me the same question, what the West should do. And my response is that you have the toolkit in your hands. The package of sanctions was prepared. You have weapons which you can share with Ukraine to strengthen our defense. You have financial resources to help us keep our economy running, because, of course, one of the goals that Russia pursues is to shatter us from inside and destabilize our economy, our financial system. active diplomacy must not stop. Everything that is possible should be done. And the point that I made clear, and I can repeat it here, is that this is the moment where neutrality or inability to act or willingness to wait and see how things evolve favors Russia, leads to further escalation. This is not the time for a sit-and-wait strategy. This is the time to act now, because if President Putin sees the slightest hesitation or the slightest disunity or inability of the West to act in a resolute way, it will motivate him to push further. And one of the biggest issues that has to be addressed is what will actually be the trigger for the West to slam that package of unbearable sanctions that Russia has been promised to suffer from if it invades. Because what we see already now is a heavy escalation. I receive almost every half an hour a report, a new update of what's happening. They're shooting, they're shelling, they're staging this kind of false flag operations, like accusing us of shelling the territory of Russia. So in the next days, things will evolve quickly, and we have to act. It's impossible to continue to wait for the moment. So discussions is a good thing, but sometimes there are moments when discussions have to be transformed into actions, and this is the moment.
Can I ask you, escalation, and what do your European and Western interlocutors think the trigger should be?
Well, first, we firmly believe that there are already sufficient grounds to impose certain sanctions on Russia now for what it has already done. For example, in recent years, Russia heavily passportized residents, citizens of Ukraine, residents of the government uncontrolled territories. Now, Russia is actively using this argument to explain and as an excuse for its actions, that they have to protect Russian citizens on the ground. And Russia actually, unfortunately, was never seriously punished for this policy of passportization. So, step one, there are legitimate legal reasons to impose certain sanctions now. And second, I cannot disclose all the details of our discussions, but we have to come up with a joint answer with our partners on what that trigger for the big package of sanctions should be. But it definitely shouldn't be the moment when a soldier wearing Russian uniforms with a Russian flag will solemnly cross into Ukraine in front of the cameras. This is not that kind of war. And if anyone tries to say that, okay, let's wait until we see that it's actually Russia that moved in and then impose sanctions, this is a flawed way of seeing things.
Thank you. Could I ask a member of the congressional delegation? Yes, there are a number here. Sure, sir. Why don't you answer that? I mean, in the two questions, one, given the uncertainty that we have just heard from the foreign minister, what do you think is the right time to impose sanctions?
Well, I'm Dan Sullivan. I'm the U.S. Senator from the great state of Alaska. I'm a member of the Armed Services Committee.
We're glad to be here. It's a strong bipartisan delegation for the reasons we've said. I think when there is any incursion, not a little incursion, a big incursion, any incursion by the Russian military, we trigger sanctions. But if I may, I was going to ask the panel a question that had a little broader aperture beyond just Ukraine that I think is very important. And it's a comment and a question. Secretary Mattis, you did a great job in your position writing the National Security Strategy, National Defense Strategy in the United States that said we are in an era of great power competition. I actually think, and I totally agree with that, but I think the description, a more accurate description, would be we're in an era of authoritarian aggression. And that is, to broaden the aperture here a little bit, when you think about what is happening right now in the world, you have authoritarian governments led by Russia and China who are taking aggressive actions all over the world. They're led by leaders who are solely making these decisions, frequently very isolated leaders, which is quite dangerous. They are sensitive and even paranoid to the issue of democracies on their borders who are orienting west, whether Ukraine or Taiwan, and they are reverting back to the issue that we thought we had left in the 20th century, which is might makes right. So here is my question to the panelists. Longer term, what should we be doing about this broader challenge that is posed by both Russia and China, who are increasingly working together? Of course, we have alliances. Of course, we have our democratic right. values. We have energy. And we need stronger militaries, in my view. But I would love the question to be directed at the panel on that topic.
Thank you, Senator. It is a very large question that you have asked, but if I could ask perhaps Anne Applebaum and Minister Linda to give very brief responses, because there are many more people who'd like to speak here too. Anne.
My very brief response is that we need to eliminate the means by which kleptocrats and autocrats around the world launder their money and spread their influence through our own political systems. That means eliminating money laundering. That means changing the banking system and the legal system so that they can't use anonymous companies to buy property in Western countries and in the United States, including in some American states that have rules like that. Eliminating that will also help eliminate the political influence that they have within our systems. And once we've done that, we can talk about other kinds of efforts, which I'm sure other members of the panel can speak to.
Minister Linde.
Well, thank you very much. I agree with Anne about this, but I also would like to say that we have to be much more outspoken on our values, and I really think it's good that President Biden has started this Democratic Summit and the Year of Action, and we have a drive for democracy. We have more than 600 democracy talks all over the world in all our embassies globally. To invite and get resilience in the democracy fighters and human rights defenders and journalists and media workers, because they have a tough time now, and somebody has to stand up to this authoritarian strike that are going. For the last 5 years, there has been more authoritarian countries going in the authoritarian direction than in the democratic direction. There is a change globally in the world from democratization to authoritarianism. And it's good with legal issues, but we also need to take the ideological fight. Thank you.
Michio Joanna, very brief intervention.
Thank you, Senator, for that question. That's a fundamental one. And basically what we are witnessing, it's a new clash between two ideas how to organize human society. One, an open, democratic, perfectible and challenged democratic system, and the other one, which is the opposite. Immediately under this ideological, and he's right, philosophical question, what kind of life do you want to live? in what kind of society we want to live, our kids, our grandkids. Just after that, it's a massive race for technological supremacy happening in the world after five centuries of Western dominance. Not a few decades, centuries. So whoever, and we still have the technological edge, we the West. This is why in NATO I'm doing partnerships. NATO EU, Sweden, Finland, Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, everyone else. But they also work with Australia, with Japan, with South Korea, with New Zealand, and other nations. So I, in a way, Russia is challenging in a sort of a brutal, ostentatious, but relatively traditional way our system. When it comes to China and an eventual combination between China and Russia, that's far more important. So we need all of us to perfect our democracies, and as Anne was saying, to really fight and speak up. I see no way. I lived half of my life in communist Romania. I know how it is to live in a dictatorship. And for the ones who have not lived that, I tell you, this is nothing worse than living in the dark, being afraid to speak up, being afraid to end in jail if you embrace a different idea than the dominant one. So this is time for us to really get our act together. And in a way, Russia is a sort of a wake-up call for something far larger that is here to confront all of us in the years and decades to come.
Thank you. You broadened the question to one I think that has been not much discussed at this conference yet, which is what we think the impact China can have on this situation right now. Foreign Minister Wang Yi was beamed into the conference this morning, and if I understood the translation correctly, seemed to say that China stood firmly behind the UN Charter and firmly in favor of the sovereignty of borders, which one would assume would mean that China would be against a full-on invasion. Do you think, General Mattis and General Petraeus, that China will play any role in this behind the scenes with Vladimir Putin, or are we headed for an alliance of autocrats, as we are all worried about?
Well, it's interesting that China has never recognized Russia's seizure of Crimea. Now, at the same time, there's an increasing confluence of activities between Russia and China as we see these closed societies under autocrats banding together and basically strengthening their military ties, and perhaps they would work to undercut the economic sanctions and reduce the penalty on Russia. That's something we should consider. But this goes to the point that we're seeing two diametrically opposed political systems. And if we take a longer-term view, as President of the European Commission Ursula von der Leyen says, we're going to have to get better at explaining to the young people in our democracies the value of democracy. Because in many cases, we used to use one or two sentences and dismiss any concerns about they might think that, you know, there's nothing wrong with the dictatorship. Today, we have more and more young people who have lived so safe for so long, they do not understand these are experiments, these democracies, and they can fail. And we're going to have to, in the long run, get the young people aware of this treasure and able to pass it on to the next generation. So if education and civics is not included, I think we will continue to see this growing.
And I think it's safe to say, again, that he is not keen to see some kind of great uprising that could have ramifications that stretch beyond Ukraine. If I could come back to the minister just for a second, though, because I think, it's hugely important that Ukraine not only know that there will be sanctions and a lot of other actions and so forth and a lot of diplomatic invective and so on, but there needs to be an absolute ironclad commitment up front that we are going to provide everything that they need to make Ukraine a porcupine that is indigestible by Russia. And that should be done now, very, very clearly. It has been to a degree, but that has to be as clear as the prospect of sanctions, because I don't think Vladimir Putin has finished the calculations. I think he's still in his own mind thinking through how hard will this be, not just again to force the government out of Kiev or to encircle Kiev or something like that, But how painful is it going to be to try to hold on to this? And having also done a couple of counterinsurgencies, if the host nation population really is against the invader, life can be very difficult indeed.
Mr. Kuleva, is the West providing you with everything you need to be a porcupine?
Well, until Russian soldiers remain in Donbas and in Crimea, of course, it's not enough. We need more. And we are working with partners. Those countries who have already decided to share something with us, they really prove that the famous saying that a friend in need is a friend indeed. And the United States is are the leaders of this camp. We have difficult discussions with Germany, the host country of this event, about the issue of weapons supply. But again, every country and every international organization can do what it can. Every country is special. They have their concerns, their national interests. But I cannot imagine a democracy that would say, no, there is nothing that we can do. There is nothing that we can share with Ukraine to help them sustain. Because apparently this is the fight between a democracy and an authoritarian regime. And there is one more point that I want to make. There is one thing that the West can easily do. And it really costs nothing, but it would be a game changer and would send the strongest possible message. It's granting Ukraine the status, the European perspective, and even the status of the candidate country right now. This costs nothing to the European Union. It's a political decision, but it would send a message to the people of Ukraine that you are one of us. And second, it would send a message to Putin that whatever you do, we will not abandon Ukraine. We've been having this discussion for years. EU is reluctant. There are many different views about the prospects of enlargement. But this war will come to an end when Putin finally understands that Ukraine is part of the West. It's not in the middle. It's part of the collective West. And this is something that can be done now.
Thank you. Very, very clear. I want to turn to the German delegation. Is there a member of the German delegation who would like to respond to this? Nobody? All right. Why don't you then, gentlemen? It's telling. Yes. Go ahead quickly, and then I want to turn to the US again. But it is.
Hi, thank you.
Yes. Yes, of course. We'll have you very quickly, sir, and then we'll get to the...
Yes, sir. Tobias Old, Member of Parliament for Bournemouth and Chair of the Defence Select Committee in the UK. I just want to follow on from my good friend, the Senator of Alaska, and what General Jim Mattis said. Very concerned that we are missing the bigger picture here, this tectonic alignment between Russia and China. When you look at what's happening in Ukraine right now, you could argue that this is ground zero of a wider battle between Western liberalism and authoritarianism. And when you look at it that, you then have to ask yourself whether NATO itself should recognize what it says on the tin, to defend European democracy. We are hiding behind this excuse that because Ukraine is not a member of NATO, then somehow we should not then press in and support it. I've never known a general who steps forward and tells the opposition to do X, Y, or Z. Let's actually keep our opposition guessing. A no-fly zone might be something sensible. We need to lean into this. If we don't, this will be a turning point in our history as we recognize a geopolitical change in our security, not just of Europe, but right across the world.
Thank you, Tobias Elwood. Thank you.
Excuse me, I'm a German member. I'm a German member.
Ah, very yes. Briefly,
so
thank you.
I'm a German member of the European Parliament. I'm the standing rapporteur on Ukraine, and we in the European Parliament have stood by Ukraine over the years. We have been, with a two-thirds majority, constantly against this pipeline. We have, as a majority, voted in favor of defensive weapons for Ukraine. So in this regard, the European Parliament and also German members are in the lead of what is possible with Ukraine. We have had a discussion about the status of candidate status now. We have gone as far as we could with referring to Article 49, which gives every European country an option to address and apply for membership, and we are formulating it up to the edge where we can go without formally saying now it's candidate. That is not for us in the parliament. But our sympathies are with you, and we are very much stronger, I would say, than the current German government.
Thank you. You might need to persuade the current German government, I think, but thank you very much. Let's quickly hear from a Ukrainian Member of Parliament, Member of Parliament Chernov. Are you here? Thank you. Give us your perspective.
Well, thank you very much. I totally agree with Dmitry Kuleba that we cannot wait with imposed sanctions because we have now escalation near the touch line in Ukraine, and actually it seems to be the perspective of Georgian scenario because they try to pursue the Western world, the world that Ukrainians started heavy shelling, the Ukrainians started some genocide or something like this. And actually, I totally agree with Tobias that who said that it's war between not Russia and Ukraine. It's war between authoritarian world and democratic, and we have to fight shoulder to shoulder. We do expect to your support in democratic, military, informational, any kind of support. Because we have to, they are big, but we are brave, you know? And Ukrainians are ready to fight and will fight. My parents live in just 100 kilometers behind of their front line. And we will not leave Ukraine. We will not leave Kyiv. We will fight, and we do support, do expect of your support. Please stay with us. Please impose the sanction. Start right now. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a long list of people who would still like to speak, but I suspect we are getting very close to 3 o'clock. So I'm going to take two more very quick interventions. First of all, Daryl Issa, and then, yes, there, the two, in the middle seat, the two ladies.
Thank you.
Very briefly.
Please. I'll be brief. I think when I heard the question, it really started off as a question to us about what should be the trigger, what should we do, where should we be. And I think the answer is to look backwards 6 years. 6 years ago, we responded in a very underperforming way to going into a piece of this country. The real question is, do we make it clear to Putin that whatever sanctions occur, until the behavior, which means the withdrawal from what he's taken, changes, there will be a further and further and further escalation? If over the last 6 years, after he took a piece of Ukraine, the sanction had continuously increased and he had seen more and more heat, he wouldn't be in this aggressive mode. But what he saw was a limited action. He was able to get used to it. He was able to do Nord Stream 2 during a period of time, yes, in which he was occupying another country. So I think when you asked the question a while ago, and I think Mad Dog Mattis would probably agree, that if you come after somebody and it doesn't change their behavior, you have to change your behavior. Would you agree, General?
I'm sure he would. General, can I just leave you to answer that at the very end? I want to get one more intervention in from the middle floor, and then we have to end. Yes, go ahead. Briefly.
I'm sure that you actually have much more unity right now than you had a week ago or 8 years ago. We see that, and we definitely understand that. I here represent an opposition political party as an MP, but I fully support what our Minister of Foreign Affairs has said here. And I think it's very important that we would hear today the exact understanding of what could be the trigger for your common action. Because military action is happening already today. More than 60 shellings every day. The water supplies for about 50 cities and villages has been cut off. You see that Russia is accusing already Ukraine of this false flag actions against Russian Federation. So it continues and it heats up. And I think there are more than already named reasons for sanctions to be used already today. And I think Anne Applebaum has actually clearly specified what could be done already today. Moreover, you can also act with regard to the Russian Duma that has called on Putin to recognize this occupied territories. Why not sanction all of the members of the Russian parliament? And I think, again, I would support my colleague from Servant of the People Party, it's not about the war between Ukraine and Russian Federation. It is about the war between Russian Federation and the free Western world. So it's up to you and up to us together to react. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all of you. I'm going to ask the panelists to conclude this. Prime Minister, I'm going to start with you. Firstly, we have sanctions in place now. Secondly, what in the next think will be the main?
Well, if I in Canada, I think we evolves at a very high speed as we speak, shelling their territory again. So it's time to act.
Yes, of course. Thank you. Minister Linde, the future of Europe is at risk.
Absolutely, because this is the risk for the whole European security order. That's what Russia would like to destroy. Fight for the freedom of Ukraine and to stop the attacks on Ukraine, that will have repercussion for the whole European security path, and that is not acceptable.
Thank you. Anne Applebaum, quick last. What is your last word? Are your last words from this session?
Expand the competitive space as Representative Isaac. Revolutionary idea. Governments of the people, by the people, for the people. The Russians are exposed economically around the world. They're exposed with troops. Syria. They are over. Go after them.
And David Petraeus.
Quite well, I thought, when she said that an assault on Ukraine is an reality that we face.
It is the sober reality. It looks like it is inching ever closer. Thank you all. Let us go. You need to go. Thank you all.